Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
And thanks for joining us on our Thursday edition of Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in for Tom Williams. Do you remember the debate in the Utah legislature last year over something called GRAMA, the Government Records Access Management Act? Here's a quote from a website at the Salt Lake Tribune. Last year's legislative assault on Utahns' right-to-know laws came out of the dark and caught nearly everybody by surprise. Thus, the rapid rise and ugly fall of House Bill 477 was itself a textbook example of what goes wrong when government policy is made in secret. Well, the outcome of that was an organization called Grandma Watch, a collection of media specialists who are paying attention to what's happening on Utah's Capitol Hill this year in regards to open records and Grandma. And that's the subject of the first half of our program. What's going on in the Utah legislature this year relative to Grandma? Will we see anything like 477 this year? And what related issues that you could call relate to open government are being formulated at the Utah legislature? Very pleased to have two guests with us to discuss what happened, what's likely to happen, and what's next. We have with us Joel Campbell, who is a professor in the communications department at BYU. Before, he was also a reporter and editor at the Deseret News. Also with us, Randy Wright, editor at the Provo Daily Herald, and both, I believe, active in Grandma Watch. Let me turn to you, perhaps Joel Campbell first, just for those of us who maybe are new to the state or we were asleep last year during the whole debacle over 477. Give us the speed of light history of what happened with Grandma.
Well, good morning. Yes, the last session we had a bill that popped up 72 hours before it basically passed both chambers of the legislature. House Bill 477 made major changes to our open records law, including the fact that legislators wanted to protect voicemail and text messages and other kinds of things that way. But probably even the more troubling was the there's a balancing test in Grandma that says all things being equal, the public interest outweighs those other interests that might keep a record closed. And there was a proposal basically to gut that provision of law and would have changed the dynamics amazingly. And for good reason, a lot of national groups, including the Society of Professional Journalists, said that this law would have made us, backed us up to kind of the laws that are in Albania or some Eastern Europe or whatever it might be. So it was a very awful thing, and it passed, went to the governor. He signed it into law. That prompted a lot of protests. We had protests at the Capitol two or three times. There was front page editorials in the major newspapers across the state. The legislature was called back into session, and in one short day, they repealed it all, and said we're going to have a working group. There was a working group that worked at it over the summer, and some ideas came out of that. I believe we're going to see a bill with some of those ideas, but at this point, nothing too major that would approach what House Bill 477 would have done.
Randy Wright, were you surprised by the heated, spectacular outcry over 477 last year?
Not at all, and I do think that this is something we've learned really that is very important to the people of Utah, and I think the legislature learned that also the hard way. It was unnecessary, I would say, if they had gone through the normal channels and maintained the dialogue with the media and so forth. I think that good amendments could have been made to Grandma without all that brouhaha. But I did want to just step back just for a second and just look at Grandma more generally. This is the premier open records law in America, and basically it recognizes two rights: the public's right of access to information about the public's business, the conduct of the public's business, and the right of privacy in relation to personal information that is gathered by government entities. And so GRAMA was established to reconcile those two rights, and it's not always a harmonious process, but GRAMA was created about 20 years ago to provide a rational framework for resolving those conflicts.
Randy Wright from the Provo Daily Herald and Joel Campbell with us from the Communications Department at BYU. So tell me, maybe we'll start with Randy, about this organization that formed called GRAMA Watch.
Well, after the great outcry last year from the people of Utah, and you know, we as journalists kind of feel that we are proxy for the people because we're in the business of finding information and presenting it to them. We discovered their high interest in this subject, and after the repeal and as the dust settled and we began to think about it, we in the media felt like we shouldn't just let it drop. We should come back and do something on a regular basis during a legislative session to keep people informed about legislation that could have an impact on openness. And it's not just for the people that we're doing this. I think it's fair to say we're doing this for the legislators themselves, because many of them may not even realize some of the impacts that the bills that they run might have on openness. The media coalition consists of, it's sort of a loose coalition, I suppose, of the Salt Lake Tribune, the Deseret News, the Daily Herald, the Utah Society of Professional Journalists, the Utah Press Association, and from time to time we're joined by TV stations. But the purpose of following through here was to just not let the issue of openness and legislation that could impact openness drop after the repeal of 477. We want to keep it out in front of the public and let people know what various bills mean in terms of government access.
So, Joel Campbell, you've got a watch list, and I think a week or so ago there were only three items, and it's grown considerably. You just emailed me some of the bills that are being watched.
Right, and so we tried to make it simple. We know people are busy and that legislators are busy, but it's, you know, it's a real simple idea. Bright light is something we support. It increases openness in government, or it helps to create more transparency. We have a pale light, which is kind of a neutral stance, and then we have lights out, which basically says this would harm the public's right to know and ability to get information about their government.
So one of the first acts that got a negative reaction had to do with voter records and date of birth. There are various ratings for other legislation as well. One of my favorites here is a representative who proposes to open caucus meetings, and we know how that works in the legislature when one party has a veto override control of both houses and they go in to meet amongst themselves. They can determine the outcome of legislation behind closed doors. So that's the caucus. One of the representatives wants to open caucuses. But as a statement, he has a separate bill to make it easier to close public meetings. I don't quite get that.
And he basically admitted that was a joke bill. He was trying to show, this was Representative Powell from Heber City, trying to show the citizens that and the legislators that if you, you know, if you wanted, just kind of on a whim, want to close a meeting, that you could close it. Not everybody was amused. I think we were kind of amused, but at the same time said, lights out. This is a very bad idea for us to ever to become law. But it was more perhaps of a message bill. But so, yeah, that was interesting. I think the political caucus bill, the one that you're looking at probably is Senator Romero, Ross Romero, who's the Senator Minority Leader, the Democrat, leading Democrat. And it may get a hearing, but usually it's been reproposed in the past and usually doesn't get past the first hearing.
Yeah, sometimes they call it a success when a bill gets its first committee hearing, which indicates a level of support for something like forcing open the caucus meetings.
Right, right.
Well, let's go. Fundamentally, I think Senator Bramble is running the bill that will sort of address what they tried to do last year, but he promises it will be non-controversial and it will be much more popular. And
I'd like to just call out Senator Bramble, and he and Senator Valentine and Speaker Lockhart have been friends of open government, and I think they're both on the record as saying we are not going to run any amendments to Grandma without full buy-in from all the parties concerned, and they have kept that promise. And there is a bill from Bramble that is being developed right now in conjunction with the Media Coalition, and we're working over the language with him now. And it's very true that he has stood behind his promise to not move forward unless we have consensus.
We're talking about GRAMA, Government Records Access Management Act, how Utah can access government records, how reporters or anyone can file a request to look at records that should not be kept secret. What's happening in the Utah legislature this year? Just a reminder, our guests with us live on the phone, Randy Wright, editor at the Provo Daily Herald, and Joel Campbell, associate professor in the College of Fine Arts and Communications at BYU, former reporter at the Deseret News. If you have thoughts on this topic, which became so controversial last year, you can call us at 1-800-826-1495. Have you ever tried to find a government record and filed a GRAMA request? Have you had an opinion about what happened last year? We'd love to hear from you. So let me just ask both of you, is there a bill or likely to be a bill that is of most concern this year? Joel?
I think that there's nothing that really has come up to the never to the level of the HB 477. I mean, I think there's a few things that that may be a little bit troubling that we're asking questions about, but nothing to that level. Randy, maybe you want to talk a little bit about some of the provisions you're talking about with Senator Bramble. I think those are probably where most of the discussion is going on right now.
Right. The in preface to that, I would say there's, if anything, there's been a little bit of a rush on the part of legislators to get bright light bulbs. Nobody wants to be the dim bulb, so we've actually seen some good efforts to with bills that are coming up to open government. For example, John Dougal has a midterm vacancy amendments bill, HB 491, which will open up the process of city councils, for example, making interim appointments, like if a mayor resigns or dies, as happened in Orem. And since that's a substitute for an election, it should be an open process, not a closed process, as was done in Orem and South Jordan recently. But going to the Bramble bill with Grandma amendments, there are several really nice pieces of that. One is the establishment of a records ombudsman at the state level, which would help people navigate their way through GRAMA. If they're denied a request, a person can appeal to this ombudsman and get advice and learn how to navigate the system. And also public officials can use it, because not all of them are completely familiar as they should be with all the nuances of GRAMA. There's a language about litigation, about reasonably imminent litigation that the Media Coalition thinks is reasonable, and that we should be able to, that the government ought to be able to withhold certain information about things that are subject to litigation. But this is some language we're working on. We don't want it to be too broad, because attorneys will have a tendency to close you off when they shouldn't. Another one is language that relates to the Deseret News versus Salt Lake County case that sort of gave rise to this whole HB 477 brouhaha. And it turns out that the process was good in that case, and the Utah Supreme Court held that the public interest was served by the release of certain records in that case. And that reasoning is now being adopted into GRAMA in the Bramble bill.
I have a couple of follow-ups, but let's take a caller. Again, our topic on Grandma and the organization Grandma Watch. Jan in Hiram is with us. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I agree that records should be open, but there's an issue that most people probably aren't aware of that has come up, and that's that a lot of companies are taking advantage of this law, and they're coming to counties and they're requesting their entire database. And these counties are having trouble deciding what to do because they don't feel it's right to just give out the record for commercial gain, but there's not been any way they've found where they can really restrict that, because if they don't give the records, then they personally and as a county are liable. And so I know that my husband works for a county, and so we've been struggling with this, and, you know, it's kind of a give and take. Information should be public, but should, you know, companies be able to take all this public information and make money on it when the government is managing it, they're collecting it, they're trying to keep it safe? And so that's, you know, something they've been struggling with. And the only thing so far that they found is that they can charge a fee for each record, you know, for the care and the copy of it. And these companies are willing to pay tens of thousands of dollars to get this data. They're happy to just hand over the money.
Interesting.
So I think it's a public issue. You know, the county officials don't necessarily feel like they should give out everybody's data. If you have a reason to come get a record, that's fine. But legally, they haven't been able to find any way around it, and so they're having to basically give or sell everything.
I'd like to speak to that briefly. A government should not be the victim of a commercial request, voluminous requests, where people are using the data that's collected by the government. But if the records are open, they've got to be open to anybody. A company is no different, really, from a private person. If the record is open, it's open. And so you raise a good question, but we feel that the answer to that is in how much is charged for the record. And companies, as you described, need to pay the reasonable costs of the government incurs when they go out and accumulate records on behalf of somebody and give them a large volume. That should be paid for.
Could I also respond to this for a moment?
Please.
Yes. So, I mean, this has been kind of the heart. There's two issues here. One is the cost, and the second one is privacy. And I think she touched on that idea of privacy. And that's become a big issue on the voter registration database. That's probably the largest database that we know of in the state that's maintained by the Lieutenant Governor's Office, where every registered voter is a part of that. And there is this, you know, a very interesting debate going on about should companies, well, in this case it's political parties for the most part, or marketing companies be able to purchase the entire database. They charge like a couple thousand, I think, for that. They might charge more for commercial interests, but political parties have to pay like $1,000 for the entire database. But in this session we have two bills up that would redact emails. I think that one's going to pass. The other one we're kind of debating about, and that's birth dates. And there's good reasons, I think, to close off birth dates, and there's good reason to keep them open. Obviously, I fall on the side of openness because these kinds of records have been able to use to find voter fraud. Miami Herald used it in a Pulitzer Prize-winning piece where they were able to show that a lot of people were voting as dead voters. So, yes, this is kind of the classic clash between privacy and openness. And some states have adopted commercial use. But I think that Randy's right on target when he says that they ought to have to pay. If it's for commercial use, they have to pay to get that.
Jan, interesting situation. Any follow-up comments or questions?
Well, I think, you know, the government is kind of a public trust, and so to be selling our data, I understand that you should be able to come and get data, and if they want to get on the website and collect it one record at a time, that's fine. But I think to just ask these people that are working to use the data for government purposes that are required to sell it, because these companies are happy to pay $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. It's no big deal. So they're obviously making a significant amount of money off of this data. And I think there's a balance, but I'm not sure that the balance is in the right place at this time.
Okay, Jan, thank you very much. Appreciate it. 1-800-826-1495. Still a few minutes left on this topic. If you have a comment about government records and Grandma and the Utah legislature, let me put another question to both of you. I know that the legislative leadership was really unhappy with the way 477 unfolded last year. They don't like to have to admit they are wrong, go back in a session and repeal something that they felt strongly about earlier. And I'm still guessing there might be a desire in some areas, some members of the legislature, to exact some kind of punishment over this. Do you have any sense of that?
I'm not sensing that. In fact, everywhere you turn, you find legislators admitting they were wrong, and that's okay. I think the collision here was healthy. It was good for the people of Utah ultimately, because it brought something out into the open that was important to people, and the people weighed in.
And I think it's been healthy too, because I think that the politicians have realized that sunshine in government, open government's a good thing, and it's actually a good thing to run on. We have Governor Herbert, who said, "You either pass an ombudsman bill, or I'll make an executive order to create one." His opponent, Greg Frank, in the legislature, has also proposed a bill that says if you have a meeting of two or more people, it becomes a meeting, and you can't go off the. You have to use the Open Meetings Act. It's just not going anywhere, but he's going to be able to campaign on the fact that he's for open government. So, to me, the discussion I think helped refocus that. This is something the public cares about, and frankly, it's made it a campaign issue.
So you don't think there will be a lot of lights-out category bills that ultimately get passed?
I don't think so. I think this year they're holding back on those kind of bills.
And finally, for persons who want to track these issues, is there a central site or a place to go to follow Grandma Watch?
Yes, the Salt Lake Tribune has a website called UtahsRIGHT.com, UtahsRight.com, and right at the very top of that page it says Grandma Watch. You click on that button, and it brings up all the bills and a summary of each of the bills and the rating for each of the bills we're following.
That's an interesting site. They also, you know, track public employee salaries and a lot of other records issues there. Yeah. Well, I think we're ready to transition into our next topic, which will be dual immersion language education. But I want to thank our guests first off, Randy Wright, editor at the Provo Daily Herald. Randy, thanks for taking time.
My pleasure.
And Joel Campbell, associate professor in the communication department at BYU, former reporter and editor at the Deseret News. Joel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Stay with us. We've got Ed Cosilia in one of his weekly essays from Mexico, and then we'll return to talk about dual immersion.
I read the news today, oh boy.
Sitting here at the tip of Land's End, 1,000 miles from the U.S. border, it's interesting that, well, we seem to get our news faster than when we were in the States. No, really, we do. And it isn't coming through traditional means. We've been down here almost a year now, and there have been some fairly large news events that have taken place. Osama bin Laden and Muammar Gaddafi were killed. There were monster tornadoes in the United States and violent earthquakes across the globe. We haven't missed a beat of the presidential primary that's in full swing right now, and we keep tabs on pop culture, like the recent passing of singer Whitney Houston. Instead of the traditional news platforms, though, we learned of these events through social media giants like Facebook and Twitter. It's how we keep in touch with the world. Now, stepping back about 7 years ago, there were a few of us in the media, only a few of us, on the editorial and advertising sides of the wall who saw it all coming. We understood that if you could send an email through cyberspace and get it to a destination halfway around the world in milliseconds, somebody, somewhere, would figure out that they could disseminate news in the same fashion, and that if you could post news that quickly, you could market your product to advertisers who understood that instant access to news and information meant a larger, more voracious audience to place your advertising in front of. Facebook and Twitter are proving that true once again. Saturday, as news of Houston's death played out on Facebook, the CNN anchor could only vamp to fill airtime, repeating over and over that the singer had died, but they had no other information. Meanwhile, my Facebook page was filling up with news items as they broke, links to her movies and songs, and responses from the rich and famous. Updates shot out across the internet via Reuters, the Associated Press, the Huffington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, which made a remarkable comeback about 10 minutes into the story with some fine coverage on the fly. But it all flowed through Facebook and Twitter as quickly as you could click the mouse on your computer. It's interesting, too, because supposedly Facebook and Twitter are thought of in the States as being primarily associated with a younger, hipper crowd. Here, however, we are meeting a lot of people from around the globe who are not so young, but apparently fairly hip. They keep tabs on not only friendships, but current events through social media. Now, of course, when you do start following stories in social media, you also have to contend with the snarky comments that people leave. It can, at times, seem very tabloid-esque, as besides the news, you also get a hamper full of dirty laundry. But if you can weed through all the negatives associated with social media, and believe me, there are plenty, you can get the news accurately and quickly, whether you are in Los Cabos or Salt Lake City. This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.
Glad you're with us for our Thursday edition of Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in for Tom Williams, and we're moving from politics and government records to language education and something called dual immersion. Relatively new but growing trend in Utah schools, dual immersion is a program in which students spend half the day in English with a teacher and half the day in a second language, acquiring both language and cultural competency. And we're going to explore the ins and outs of that program in this portion of the program. Again, we are also live, and if you have a question or comment, please feel free to call us at 1-800-826-1495. Let me introduce the first two of what we expect will be three guests with us. Sandra Talbot is a world language consultant in the Utah State Office of Education and project director with the Utah Chinese Dual Language Immersion, and Ophelia Wade, also a language specialist. And Ophelia, is it with the Canyon School District?
Actually, I wear two hats. I am a specialist of dual language immersion in Canyon's district, but I also have the role as director of the Spanish and Portuguese dual programs in the state.
And we do have, I understand, our third guest with us, Johanna Watzinger-Tharp, a professor of languages and literature at the University of Utah. And thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, I'd like first to have each of you give us a perspective on dual immersion. I, frankly, am from the generation where, sadly, I came through both public schools and college with no requirement in foreign language competency. I think I took one semester in high school in Spanish. It was a separate program. You go to your foreign language class. And I don't think anything like dual immersion existed at the time I was coming up through the schools. Do you want to start out, Sandra?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think that your experience echoes many of the experiences of the parents of the students that we have in our program. And one of the reasons that we're getting a lot of parent support is because these parents see having a second language as a huge benefit, a skill that their children can take forward as they progress into what we're seeing now as this global economic environment. And they realize that the experiences that they had learning language, like yours, weren't as successful. And the research behind having these immersion experiences for the students in elementary schools, starting learning the language at a younger age, has so much more effectiveness and benefit to these kids.
Johanna Watzinger-Tharp, is there a lot of research to suggest that this model is really productive?
Absolutely. Children acquire languages all over the world, actually, two or more languages simultaneously. And in the U.S., of course, we think of learning a language as something very challenging and something that typically starts at a later age. But research very much demonstrates that children have the capacity to acquire multiple languages and actually benefit cognitively from the experience of navigating two languages and processing information in two languages. And that's exactly what our dual immersion programs do. They teach children subject matter in two languages, half of the day in one language, half of the day in the other. And the research shows that the children don't fall behind academically in the subjects or have any kind of disadvantage. In fact, the research shows that they have advantages over their monolingual peers.
By the way, this is kind of off topic, but Johanna, just as a follow-up, there's a popular conception that someone in my position who got through school and college and many years outside and is pretty much through a work career is too late to acquire another language. If you don't get it as a young person, you're stuck.
Well, yeah, research in the 70s and 80s very much focused on what's called the critical period, where we said, well, you know, once you have missed sort of the boat by about 8 to 10, it's going to be very difficult and challenging to acquire a second language or to learn a second language. And that is true to some extent, but we have many examples of very successful adult learners. And you may not have a speech that has a very little or no accent, but there are very few learners of a second language who don't have some kind of accent. And in fact, all of us have some kind of accent. So it's more the fear of adults of learning it, but it's definitely, you know, we have the competence, the capacity to acquire multiple languages. And of course, it's much better to start early. That's why we have the dual immersion programs. That's the optimal situation. But that does not mean that teenagers or young adults or adults should not try to acquire a second language for whatever purposes they might want to use it.
Thank you. That was kind of off topic, but it was a question I was interested in. So let me turn to you, Ophelia Ward. How does this function in a setting like the Canyon School District, for example?
Well, Canyon School District, for example, has currently 8 programs that we offered for students starting in first grade for 7 of those programs and 1 starting in kindergarten. So we have 3 Spanish programs, 3 Chinese Mandarin programs, and 2 French programs. And as you were describing and introducing the program, these are children that whose parents opt to put them in these programs. As Sandy has indicated, these are parents that see the relativity of having their children, the importance of having their children attain a second language early in their lives, with the prospects that these children will continue with the language into their college preparations. So by the time they arrive at the college level, these are students who will be able to actually pursue professional training using that second language, which in today's global economy becomes really an necessary, a very competitive skill, and one that for many of them will open doors in that workforce. So these parents opt to put the children in these in the programs, in the immersion programs. The children attend half the day, as you explain, receiving the regular curriculum content, curriculum that is prescribed for the children in Utah by the State Office of Education, and that is delivered in English, and half of that curriculum is delivered in the target language.
Again, we're talking about dual immersion in Utah, and if you perhaps are a parent and wondering if this would be appropriate for your child, this would be a good time to call in, 1-800-826-1495. Sandra Talbot, how many schools in the state have experimented with or adopted dual immersion language programs?
It's been very exciting because the growth has surpassed, I think, what any of us expected. Currently, we have 57 programs, but I next year we anticipate 80 programs across 5 languages that will begin doing instruction in Chinese, French, Spanish, Portuguese, and a new language, German, which we're very excited about. These schools, most of the schools that we see right now are Spanish, and I believe that Chinese is next in number. French follows, and then adding the Portuguese and the German next year will be something that will be a new challenge for us, but that we're really excited to take. The Spanish immersion programs have students that have already progressed up into some of the upper grade levels, fourth and fifth grade. Chinese and French right now are capping out at the third grade, so we have students that we have in our programs from kindergarten all the way up to the fifth grade. And the, as I said, the goal, it's just really growing exponentially, and the goal that the state has set is to have 100 programs across the 5 languages by 2014, and I think that we'll actually meet that goal in the 2013-2014 school year because we've got so much demand by parents.
We know that resources are tough in the public schools in Utah, especially with the large enrollment. Is this a resource intensive? Does it cost extra money?
You know, this is one of the wonderful things about these immersion programs is the greatest cost comes from the teacher that the school district is using in that immersion classroom. But because of the way this model is set up, they are not hiring a special language teacher that just comes in as an extra cost to the district. This is a teacher that normally would be hired in their classroom at any regard, and so there's no additional cost for the instruction. You have 50 students that are in a first grade classroom or a first grade group. You have 25 that will start with the target language teacher, and 25 that will start with the English teacher. At lunch, those two classrooms switch their instruction. So basically you have the two teachers who would typically be teaching anywhere from 50 to 60 students are still teaching 50 to 60 students. There's no additional cost. The other cost that we do see coming is the specialized curriculum of the target languages. And there has been some wonderful support by the Utah State Legislature to give schools grants to acquire these specialized curriculum materials. But even still, it's relatively low in its cost. The thing that's so exciting about this is that it's a sustainable program. If funding disappears, the teacher doesn't disappear. The schools have that teacher embedded in their program, and the curriculum materials can be acquired. They're relatively inexpensive. They can be required by the districts. And so that was our goal when we began this, is that this would not be something that would come and disappear, but it would be sustainable in the schools and it would be able to continue these programs whether or not specialized funding was available.
Let me reintroduce our guests. Our topic, obviously, dual immersion programs in our Utah schools. Our guest, Ophelia Wade, is with the Canyon School District and the Utah State Office of Education, specializing in this area. Also from the Utah State Office of Education, Sandra Talbot, and from the University of Utah Languages and Literature Department, Professor Johanna Watzinger-Thorpe, also Associate Dean in the College of Humanities at the U. Let me turn to you in terms of the research on dual immersion. Had there been any concern that at the youngest levels, the youngest students, there is the possibility of some confusion moving between these two worlds and two languages?
No, absolutely not. And that's when you go to the classrooms or when you watch some of the recordings of the classroom with the children, they just take that for granted that they're now operating in two languages. And the research shows that the children, there's no confusion at all with the two languages. They just, when they hear their teacher speaking Chinese, say in the first part of the day, that's just what they do, and they just go along with it. And for them, after just a short while, that's just the normal situation. And again, as I mentioned earlier, when we look around the world, that is the norm more than the exception, that you have children growing up with two languages. If you think of Asia, many countries, children in India, for example, speak the language, the particular one of the many languages of India, and also acquire English at the same time in school. So that is more the norm than the exception, and we are concerned about it because we think of it from our perspective in the U.S., where learning a second language seems like such a huge challenge, just as you described it at the beginning of the program. But for children, to acquire multiple languages is just sort of the normal thing. They just navigate them and they operate in them, and that's for them, that's just the normal situation. I wanted to just add something about, since Sandy mentioned the teachers, and that is really one of the other wonderful elements of the dual immersion project in Utah. It has really stimulated very productive partnerships between institutions of higher education and the school districts and the schools. Teacher education is really one of the critical elements, preparing teachers for working with young language learners for the particular model of dual immersion and introducing them to the research and understanding of dual immersion when they work together, when the language teacher works together with an English-speaking teacher. And we've had a really great relationship now with the districts in preparing teachers and creating programs, teacher education programs, that can support this wonderful project of dual immersion.
Of course, we're all aware that we live in an increasingly diverse society, and I've heard it said often, if you want to see diversity in Utah, go visit a public school classroom. So tell me how this works for the student who comes into the system with English as their second language, or barely a language at all, coming from parents and family where there is very little English spoken.
Can I address that, since I deal with that more in terms of our Spanish speaking population? Actually, I did want to bring up something as a follow up as well. This is not necessarily a new experiment in Utah. The dual language immersion model has been around for almost 60 years now, and it has shown to be very, very effective, as Johanna has explained. We have had some extensive research specifically focusing on how it impacts the second language learners who, as you described, come in knowing very little English, and then they're spending half the day maintaining their target language, their native language, and at the same time learning English as a second language. And the research is again showing that this is probably the most effective educational model for these students in terms of closing achievement gaps for them, as well as enabling them to be continuing to be bilingual and maintaining both their native language and their newly acquired language at high levels of proficiency.
Anyone else want to comment on that particular issue?
Well, I would just add that since I'm over the Chinese dual language immersion program, we see trilingual students as well, students who have English and maybe Spanish spoken at home, and now they're learning Chinese. And these students, as Ophelia has indicated, they excel in the curriculum, they excel in the language. What Johanna has referred to previously about these children really not being aware that they are functioning in two or three different languages, I see that in the classrooms exhibited time and time again, where a student is moving between English, Spanish, and Chinese very effectively. They don't appear as though they're going through any translation process. They're just simply accessing what their brain has stored in each of these languages. And as Ophelia said, these trilingual students this is a model that really is effective for these trilingual students. So that's what I would add.
Beyond the acquisition of language skills, is there also the component of cultural literacy, understanding beyond just how to put together a sentence in another language?
Oh, definitely. It goes so far beyond that. We are, I think, one of the tremendous benefits that we see in addition to that linguistic advantage that the students have is that opportunity to develop this global perspective and ability to literally, I think, see with new eyes, hear with new ears, and think and entertain new perspectives, because it is any time we're exposed to culture in general, I think we awaken our understanding and expand our ability to perceive things. And these students are having those experiences from the time they're very young. One of the wonderful experiences that we're having is that Utah has been able to establish relationships with some of our neighboring countries, not so neighboring countries, but other countries like China. We have a partnership with Spain, with Mexico, where we are able to bring in some professional teachers to staff some of our immersion classrooms. And one of the great advantages that these guest teachers bring with them is that they bring that live culture into the classroom and literally, in many ways, provide our students with an international experience right here at home.
Yeah. If I may,
and I would just add that these aren't just simple arts and crafts kinds of instruction in the classroom. The literature that the students are reading in the target language really give them a strong background into the development of the culture. So as they go through the language or the literacy component of the target language, they're accessing authentic materials that open up a window to them in the history of the culture and how things have evolved, which is such a huge advantage.
And is that Johanna who also wanted to add?
Yeah, and I think it's also not just that they're introduced to a new culture, a different culture, but also that it makes them reflect on their own culture and not even just look for differences, but also for similarities across the different cultures and hence promote understanding between the cultures. And I think we can start with that early enough to sort of have that perspective on examining one's own culture while accessing and learning about another culture.
And that is one of also indications of the research that has been done is that generally children who participate in immersion programs seem to develop an ability to feel at ease with people with diverse backgrounds and linguistic capabilities. They seem to be able to navigate that diversity with ease and feel comfortable in it, which I believe that is one of the essential skills that our students entering that global workforce are going to need.
I have a couple of other things I hope I get to, but before we run out of time, I don't want to overlook one of the obvious practical questions here. For parents with young children who will be entering school who want more information about dual immersion, if it's available in their school district or at their local school, or wonder if their child is right for the program, where can they go for information?
The initial place to go would be to the Utah State Office of Education webpage. We have under World Languages, they can locate the link to dual language immersion, and they will find information there and contacts for each of the directors of the programs for each of the languages. Another way that they can find out is to contact the world language specialist in their districts and or the curriculum department if they don't know who that specialist is, and they will direct them to that person in their district who oversees the world language programs under generally which they will find the dual language immersion programs.
Each one of us tries to maintain a website for each of the specific languages, and typically, you can find which individual schools are offering immersion programs, dual language immersion programs in their neighborhood. So that's another avenue to go directly to a school. If they go on the website and they see that a neighborhood school is offering it, they can contact that school as well.
Yeah, and that is the case for Lakeview Elementary in the Provo School District that is going to offer immersion. And when you go to the school website, you will see right on the first page that it announces the German dual immersion program to start in the fall. So directly going to the school is a very good way to find out as well.
I often get phone calls from parents wanting to know where are the schools, where are the programs being offered. And again, if you go to that USOE webpage, there is a listing of all the dual immersion schools in the state of Utah. And so that would be a good point of reference for parents.
And the USOE web address is?
The main address would be www.usoe.gov.
Okay.
And then within there, you can search for the link to the dual language immersion programs, and it will direct you to the information that Ophelia is referring to.
Well,
USOE.org. I'm sorry, it's USOE.org.
Glad we got there, because we really are going to run out of time before I get to some other questions. Here's one just offhandedly. You talked about Portuguese as perhaps the newest addition to dual immersion in Utah, and French as the third tier in the programs. But some have suggested, French is a great language, but if you really want to succeed today, it's either Spanish or Mandarin Chinese.
I believe that the point here is that gaining that second language early in life is going to be the critical factor. So when parents say, which language should my child study, I said, all of them. At one point or another, but I think what is critical and the opportunity that we want to make sure we provide for the children here in Utah is that opportunity to pick up that second language early in their lives.
Yeah.
And I would want to add very quickly that a few years ago, both Johanna and I were attending a summit of business leaders in Utah called the Metro Language Series Summit, and Johanna was the co-chairman of that, so I don't want to take this from you, Johanna, but one of the key pieces that we did try and investigate through the Utah business leaders is what languages did they want our children to learn? What do they see as the new up-and-coming economic languages?
And these
five are there.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're out of time. We'll have to leave it there. A lot of fascinating follow-up questions, but we don't have time. We've been talking about dual immersion in Utah. Johanna Watzinger-Tharp, professor of languages and literature at the University of Utah, also associate dean. World Language Consultant with the Utah State Office of Education, Sandra Talbot, and also from there and from the Canyon School District, Ophelia Wade. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate your joining us today on Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in for Tom Williams. Appreciate your joining us. Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.